My theme, then, today is what does it mean to be a human person? Who am I? What am I? The answer is not at all obvious. All of us, I am sure, have from time to time gone through identity crises. I recall one such crisis 40 years ago when I was at the International Congress of Orthodox Theological Schools meeting in Athens. I was introduced to the then Dean of the Theological Institute of St. Sergius in Paris, Father Alexis Kniazev. I was introduced to him by Father John Meyendorf, said, "Here is Father Kallistos." And Father Kniazev, looking over his spectacles at me in a quizzical way, said, quite firmly and bluntly, "You are not Father Kallistos." I was a bit taken aback. It's not often one has one's identity flatly denied. So I said to him, "Why do you say that?" And he said, again, with great emphasis, "You are not Father Kallistos. I have read a number of texts written by Father Kallistos, and I can tell from the way he writes that he must be a very old man." And with that, he turned on his heel and went away, leaving me somewhat nonplussed. This was then reinforced by an exchange with the tax authorities shortly afterwards. They wrote to me and said, "We have received a tax return from Timothy Ware," because I still use my civil name for banking and taxing purposes. "But," they said, "living at the same address, there is someone called Bishop Kallistos of Dioclea, and he hasn't sent in a tax return." Now, if the tax people consider that you are one person, and you are in fact two, then you can prove your point by both of you turning up simultaneously at the tax office. But if they think you are two people, and you are in fact one, how do you prove your point? So, as you see, personhood has its complications. And that is the theme that I would like to begin with today. The person as mystery. And I might take as my epigraph the sad cry of King Lear in Shakespeare's play, "Who is it that can tell me who I am?" This is a dominant conviction among not just Orthodox but modern Western thinkers in general during the last two centuries. We know and understand only a small part of ourselves. The human person constitutes a mystery. In the words of the German romantic poet Novalis, "The greatest secret is man himself." And C.G. Jung speaks of the psyche as a foreign, almost unexplored country. Personhood cannot be defined. We can do no more than point to what is meant and indicated, providing an ostensive definition. From our living experience, we have a sense of what it means to be a person. But this knowledge is far from being exhaustive. We don't know how far being a person goes. We don't know what, if anything, could properly be described as the fulfillment of being a person. What are the possibilities as yet latent in human personalness? What are all the demands that would have to be made on and met by men and women as persons if men and women are to be truly and fully persons? So personhood is irreducible. The mystery of the fact of being a person cannot be reduced to the facts of the different appropriate sciences. The reality of being a person is far more than any explanation that we choose to give of it. An intrinsic feature of personalness is to be open, always to point beyond. The human person is that in which new beginnings are continually being made. And here we may contrast a person with a computer. A computer reorganizes what is fed into it. It can discover connections of which we might happen to be unaware. But a computer does not make new beginnings. Only human persons can do that. This is emphasized by St. John in the first epistle of John. What we are to be in the future, he says, has not yet been revealed. So, to be a person is a sign of hope. That is fundamental to personhood. A sign of hope, of possibilities still to be realized. To be human, to be personal, is to be unpredictable, creative, self-transcending. So that, I think, is where we must start. The human person as mystery. On the Delphic Oracle in classical times, there was written up, "Know yourself." And this is a theme that Christian writers have taken up. Clement of Alexandria in the 2nd century says, "The greatest of all lessons is to know yourself. For if someone knows himself, he will know God. And if he knows God, he will become like God." But such self-knowledge, as classical authors and Greek fathers realized, is not easy. What is my true self? The bounds of each person are exceedingly wide, overlapping with those of other persons, interpenetrating. We realize our personhood through being in relationship with others. The bounds of each person range over space and time and reach out of space into infinity, out of time into eternity. Now, for the Greek fathers, there was a specific reason for this mysterious, indefinable character of the person. The human being is made in God's image and likeness. Genesis 1:26-27. Our personhood is a created icon of the uncreated God. Now, since God is incomprehensible, so also is the human person. As Gregory of Nyssa writes, has anyone ever understood his own intellect, nous? And he goes on, an image is only truly such insofar as it expresses the attributes of its archetype. One of the characteristics of Godhead is to be in its essence beyond our understanding. And so the image should also express this. In our talk about humans, as well as in our talk about God, there needs to be an apophatic dimension. Negative theology demands as counterpart negative anthropology. So that is the point from which I would like us to start today. The human person as mystery beyond our understanding. The heart is deep, it says in the Psalms. Now, this morning, let me develop one aspect of what it means to be a person. And here I shall think of the human person as microcosm and mediator. This afternoon, I shall look at what does it mean to be in the image and likeness of God. But let me begin with another general point, as well as saying that the human person is mystery. We do not find in the Greek fathers, in the seven ecumenical councils, any definition of personhood. The early centuries of Christian doctrine, which are normative for orthodoxy, were concerned with the doctrines of the Trinity and of Christ, subsequently also of the holy icon. But the human person was not a specific subject for discussion and debate during the early centuries. There are just a very few works by early Christian writers on personhood, particularly that by Gregory of Nyssa, from which I've already quoted. Now, of course, the question of what is a person is certainly implicit in the debates about the Trinity and Christology. We say that God is three persons in one essence. What do we mean by the word person or hypostasis when we apply it to God, and does it have the same meaning as when we apply it to humans? Equally, we say of Christ, the incarnate God, that he is one person in two natures. But how exactly are we to understand this one personhood of Christ? So the question of what is a person is certainly there in the background, in the debates within the early church. But it doesn't come into the foreground. So then, let's look at a dominant model, microcosm and mediator. And here I start from St. Gregory of Nazianzus this time, Gregory the Theologian, Oration 38. One of the key texts about personhood in the Greek Fathers. Here he's concerned to emphasize that the human person is a diversity in unity, a complex unity, a single whole embracing many aspects. And therein lies our particular human vocation. He distinguishes two levels of creation. On the one side, the invisible and the spiritual, and on the other side, the material and the physical. Here he is speaking in Platonist terms, but as he goes on, he balances Athens by Jerusalem. Now, angels belong to the first level of creation, the invisible and spiritual. Animals, he says, belong to the second level, material and physical. The human being alone lives, exists, and works on both levels at once. To quote Gregory's own words, wishing to form a single creature from the two levels, from both invisible and visible nature, the Creator Logos fashioned the human being. Taking a body from matter and placing in it the breath of life, which Scripture terms the intelligent soul and the image of God, he formed the human being as a second cosmos, a great universe within a little one. Now you may think I've got that the wrong way round. Surely the human being is a little universe within a great one. But no, Gregory quite deliberately says that the human being is the great universe, and the universe round us, the distances of outer space, millions of light years, that is the little universe. Actually, translations of this passage often get it wrong. People often translate what they expect to see rather than what is actually there in front of them. I mistranslated this when I first did a translation. But no, Gregory is very insistent, it is the human being that is the great universe. So then, Gregory continues, we have a twofold being, a mixed nature, both material and spiritual. As he puts it, earthly yet heavenly, temporal yet immortal, visible yet intelligible, midway between majesty and lowliness, one self-same being, yet both spirit and flesh. Of course, here he's moved beyond the point that we are both formed of matter and yet have a soul, and he's speaking of the fact that we are fallen beings between majesty and lowliness. That's one of the factors of our human existence as we know it in a fallen world. There's a great tension between the splendor of our human nature and its actual fragility, a great contrast between our possibilities and our actual realization. And here, in deference to our principal and his love of English literature, let me quote Hamlet. What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form, in moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me, no, nor woman neither. A little earlier Hamlet has said, O God, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space, were it not that I have bad dreams. In Judaism, actually, there is a special prayer for good dreams, though I don't know whether we have such a prayer in our Christian tradition. But why not? Dreams are very important to the human person. So then, that's a basic contrast between our spiritual aspect and our material existence. And this constitutes our distinctive human task, to hold in balance and in harmony these two aspects of our dual nature. We can act as mediators. Angels cannot, in the same way, mediate. Angels may be thought of as on a higher level than humans, but if we are not at the top of creation, yet we are at the crossroads in a way that angels are not. Actually, there is a tradition which says that humans, by virtue of their mixed nature, are not lower than the angels, but actually higher. We have greater possibilities than the angels have. Though this is probably not the prevailing view. As it says in Psalm 8, thou madest him a little lower than the angels. However, Gregory, having distinguished these two aspects of our human nature, doesn't stop there. As well as balancing, harmonizing, and unifying the creation in ourselves, we are also to transcend ourselves, he insists. He says, guided by God's providence, we are to be deified or divinized. The human being is a creature that has received the call to become God. So he defines the human being as zoon theoumenon, a living being that is being deified. So the supreme goal of humans is theosis, to become partakers of the divine nature. And exactly this possibility of partaking in the divine nature is, says Gregory, the culmination of the mystery. Gregory concludes by speaking of the separation of soul and body at death, and then of their future reintegration at the resurrection on the last day. Thus, he says, God has joined together soul and body, and though he separates them, he will hereafter bind them together once more in a yet more glorious way. So, Gregory's description in Oration 38 of the human person sees our humanness in terms of microcosm and mediator. Microcosm. The human person is a second cosmos, cosmos devteros, earthly yet heavenly, existing on both spiritual and material levels. By virtue of our mixed dual nature, we reflect and embrace the different aspects of the created world. The human person is imago mundi, an icon of the world. So Origen writes, understand that you have within yourself upon a small scale, a second universe. Within yourself, there is a sun, there is a moon, and there are also stars. Passage that pleased Jung. We reflect the richness, complexity, variety of the universe, visible and invisible. As St. Nilus of Ancyra says in the 5th century, I write up names on the blackboard, or the whiteboard as in this case, because the first time I gave a lecture in the University of Oxford, when my audience went out, one person forgot his notes, and I made the mistake of looking at them. And I was appalled how he had got everything garbled and muddled up, and all the proper names were misspelt. So after that, I do write up names. Not always, but much of the time. So Nilus of Ancyra, or Ankara as it is today, says, you are a universe within the universe. Look within yourself and see there the whole creation. And St. Maximus the Confessor says in a passage I'll come back to that the human person is a laboratory that contains everything in a most comprehensive fashion. A laboratory or workshop, ergasterion. So there is a first point, that the human person embraces the variety of creation. And this would bring me to a second point about the human person, that we are, because we are microcosm, we are also mediator. As microcosm, standing at the crossroads, visible yet invisible, earthly yet heavenly, body yet soul, our human vocation is to reconcile and harmonize the differing levels of reality in which we participate. We are to spiritualize the material without thereby dematerializing it. We are to make the earth heavenly. We are to unify. And so John Chrysostom describes the human person as bridge and also as bond. Syndesmos is the Greek word that he uses for bond. The Sufis used to call the human person the marriage song of the world because we bring things to unity. Now, this is developed by St. Maximus the Confessor in his text Ambigua 41. Ambigua means disputed questions. And along with Oration 38 of Greg Naz, St. Maximus the Confessor's Ambigua 41 is a key text from the Fathers on the meaning of personhood. And you can find it translated in the books on Panagiotis Nellas on deification in Christ, or Andrew Louth on Maximus the Confessor. Now, Maximus mentions various divisions in the creation, and he says that as human persons, we are to overcome these divisions. Being a laboratory, the passage I just quoted, that contains everything in a most comprehensive fashion, by virtue of his nature, man mediates through himself between all the extreme points at all the various levels of division. He has by nature full power to unite all these divisions, because in all the different aspects of his own self, he is himself related to all the extreme points and mediates between them all. It is thus the appointed task of the human person to make manifest in himself the great mystery again, of the divine intention, to show how the divided extremes in created things may be reconciled in harmony, the near with the far, the lower with the higher, so that through gradual ascent all are eventually brought into union with God. That is why the human being was introduced last into the creation as a natural bond, physikos syndesmos, of unity, mediating between the extremes because related to them all through the differing aspects of his own self, drawing them all to unity within himself, and so uniting them all to God, their cause. So, we are to unite, this is our task as humans, to unify the creation. And the means whereby this union is effected, says Maximus, is love. Descartes, at the beginning of the modern era, took as his starting point, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And he thought of the human person as essentially a thinking being. But would it not have been better for him to have said, amo ergo sum, I love, therefore I am? Thinking is not necessarily our highest or greatest faculty. Mutual love could be the highest faculty that we have. Here we see again the difference between a human person and a computer. Only human persons are capable of love. You may love your computer, but your computer doesn't love you. Now, developing this idea of the human being as microcosm and mediator, we could say the human being is king and priest of the creation. We are capable of transfiguring the world and so offering it back to God. And of all God's creation, humans alone can do this. For humans alone stand at the crossroads, at the point of meeting, and participate in the levels of creation, material and spiritual, together. But of course this has a shadow side. We humans have the ability to transform the world, but also to disfigure it. Yes, of course, animals do to a limited degree transform the environment. Bees build hives. Beavers construct dams. But they can only do so to a limited degree. We humans have far greater powers to transform the world. We are tool makers. I recall once in France, I was hurrying back from a visit to the monastery at Bussy, and I suddenly remembered that I hadn't brought a present back for my parents. And so I leapt out of the taxi into a nearby grocer's store, and there I saw a liqueur made from nuts with a squirrel on it. And as I like squirrels, I bought it. And I reflected on this idea of this bottle with a squirrel on it. Yes, squirrels collect nuts, they store them, they forget where they've put them, they quarrel with other squirrels about whose store is whose. All of these are very human characteristics. But There is one thing that squirrels, as far as I know, do not do. They do not make a liqueur out of nuts. Only humans can do that. Only humans have this gift to transform the world. Actually, the liqueur was very nasty. I would have preferred to have just the nuts. Now, if we humans are to act in this way, as mediators, as king, priest of the creation, we must be in touch with the different aspects of ourself, and more particularly with our bodies. We are not to think of ourselves as a ghost in a machine. That's a phrase that the philosopher Gilbert Ryle used to use in order to reject a view of personhood that he thought Christians often held. We are not to think of a contrast that the real person is the soul and the body is just a sort of external framework. No, we are to see our personhood as a single unity. Well, while I'm on the subject of ghosts, perhaps I might tell a story, with apologies to Irina Kirillova, because, as you will know, forgive my pronunciation, the Russian word for a guest is ghost. Well, a Russian was staying with two English people, and they had gone out, and he alone was in the house. His English was not absolutely fluent, and the telephone went, "Could I speak to Mr. Robinson, please?" "No," he said, "he passed away." "Could I speak to Mrs. Robinson, please?" "No, she passed away too." "Oh, who am I speaking to?" "This is their ghost." Well, we reject this notion of the human being as a ghost in a machine, because we are to see ourselves as a unity, body and soul together. The body is not to be seen as something external to personhood. I do not have a body, I am my body, and my body is me. The body is not a part of the person, but the whole person from one point of view. The soul is not a part, but the whole person from another point of view. The two are essentially one. That is the Christian view of personhood, not a ghost in a machine, but an integral unity. There used to be a professor in London University, Professor H.D. Lewis, not to be confused with C.S. Lewis, and he was much inclined in a Platonist manner to emphasize the distinction between body and soul. And his students used to say, "Professor Hywel Lewis does not go for a walk, he takes his body for a walk." But that we do not accept as a true explanation of personhood. And as Gregory of Nazianzus emphasizes, the separation of body and soul at physical death is something unnatural, contrary to God's plan, and only temporary, because we do not, as Christians, just believe in the immortality of the soul, we believe in the resurrection of the body. So then, microcosm and mediator. But that is not the full extent of what it is to be a human being. We are also in the image of God. We are called to transcend ourselves. We are called to unify the world with God. Not only to unify the world within itself, but to unify the world in its totality. with the Creator. Because we're in God's image, we can form a bridge, not only between the material and the spiritual, but between the created and the uncreated. So alongside the two designations of microcosm and mediator, we could put a third one, microtheos. We are God's image, not just imago mundi, an icon of the world, but imago Dei, an icon of the living God. And that is the real significance of being human. Our mediation extends beyond the created order, beyond time, into eternity. Now, the meaning of the image of God is something that I will be taking up this afternoon. So here I may stop, but perhaps end with another quotation from Gregory of Nyssa. And he plays down the idea of man as microcosm. Those who magnify human nature, he says, by comparing it to this world, saying that the human being is a microcosm, a little world, composed of the same elements as the universe, fail to realize that they are dignifying humans with the attributes of the gnat and the mouse, for they too are composed of the four elements. What great thing is it, then, for humans to be accounted a representation and likeness of the world, of the heaven that passes away, of the earth that is subject to change? The true greatness of our human personhood lies not in our likeness to the created world, but, he says, in being made according to the image of the nature of the Creator. So we reach out beyond the created order into the realm of the uncreated. And that is our true human vocation. As microtheos, the human person renders the world transparent so that God's presence shines through it. Through us humans, the world is made diaphanic or theophanic. And that is the most important feature in our humanity, that we have the infinite God as our model, that we are in his image. The divine is the determining element in our humanity. Losing our sense of God, we lose also the sense of what it is to be human. Secularization involves dehumanization. We cannot be truly human, truly personal, without God.